Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Find a nation's most important body of words, and you've found its civic Bible, says my guest today, Stephen Prothero. Gather up Huckleberry Finn and Atlas Shrugged, Woody Guthrie and Noah Webster, Ben Franklin and Malcolm X, and you've got the American Bible, he says. But don't expect sweet harmony. It is the sprawling text of a debate. This hour On Point, the words that define a nation. You can join the conversation. Will we find America in a canon of essays, speeches, songs? What makes your American Bible? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's get back to an document in the American Bible. Declaration of Independence, a little reading here from 2007. Actors Bates, Douglas, and Gibson.
When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them.
A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights.
A little sound of the American canon there from Independence Hall in Philadelphia in 2007. Actors Kathy Bates, Michael Douglas, Mel Gibson. Joining me now in our studio is Stephen Prothero, professor of religion at Boston University, author of A Nation of Religions and American Jesus. His new book is The American Bible, How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. Stephen Prothero, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
So I heard American Bible, and I just assumed right away this was some kind of version of the ancient religious text. That's not it at all. What's your project?
Yeah, the project really is to try to figure out what are the core texts in American public life that we value enough to argue about, and to try to figure out what those texts are, and then to see how the arguments particularly have played out over time. So not just exploring the Declaration of Independence, for example, but seeing how that declaration has been reinterpreted over time, what Lincoln did to it in the Gettysburg Address, what King did to it in the I Have a Dream speech, and to see the ways in which these texts function for us as a kind of scripture, as the words that we quote when we're arguing about gay marriage or when we're arguing about the separation of church and state. You know, who are our Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Is that Lincoln, Jefferson, Washington, and King? You know, who are they? So that was the idea, and that's what I've tried to present in the book.
It's a great big kind of horizon here. I mean, I'm looking at John Winthrop and Thomas Paine and Noah Webster, and then you've got Roe v. Wade, Brown versus Board of Education makes your American Bible, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Mark Twain, Ayn Rand, interestingly. We'll look at that. You know, Irving Berlin and Woody Guthrie, right on up to Dwight Eisenhower, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. It's huge. You say it's huge but not infinite, interestingly. And I'm curious how you decided what's in and what's out, whose commentary makes it and whose doesn't. It's a kind of Talmud here. But you say that the United States, America as you have it, doesn't really have a creed. It has a debate.
That's right. And, you know, this is where I think because of the Protestant background and Christian background of America, we have this tendency to want to find our Nicene Creed, you know, to say we have a common creed. And we hear this throughout American history. We've heard it more recently from George W. Bush, from Bill Clinton. America has a core idea. It has a common creed. And I just don't think that's true. I don't think you can find that at any point in American history. We have certain key words that we argue about, like liberty, like equality. And we have these core texts. But when we talk about those words, we disagree about what they mean. And when we talk about these texts, we disagree. So what joins us together, and I think this makes us more a Jewish nation in a way than a Christian nation, is that we get together to argue. And it's the arguing about our core texts, the arguing about what is America about, where have we been, where are we going, that brings us together into common cause.
But I mean, the whole point of your American Bible, bringing together all these texts, speeches, songs, even Maya Lin's Vietnam Memorial makes it into your American Bible here, is to say we're not having this debate or this argument in a vacuum. It's not just an infinite plane of ideas. There's surely a core set of
ideas that all of this text represents, or not?
Well, I disagree. I think there's a core. I think there's core texts, and then we take Lincoln and his Gettysburg Address in whatever direction we need to. After all, a lot of the issues we debate today really weren't around when our founding fathers were writing down some of these texts that are in the book, right? So they weren't worried about the internet. They weren't worried about the kind of liberty restrictions that we might have from technology. They weren't thinking about gay marriage. That wasn't even in their minds. So we need to take these texts, as people do with their scripture and religions, and apply them to new circumstances. And I think that's what we're doing, not only with these texts, but with the commentaries that I also present in the book, because I think those are as much a part of the American Bible as the core texts themselves. Is, you know, what is Sarah Palin saying about Martin Luther King? You know, what is Rush Limbaugh saying about Martin Luther King? What is Barack Obama saying about Thomas Jefferson? That's part of our conversation, too.
So to crack open your American Bible, this collection in it, it's got the Constitution in it, Declaration of Independence, Gettysburg Address, Henry David Thoreau, Civil Disobedience, you know, right on down, Thomas Jefferson's first inaugural address, Pledge of Allegiance makes it, George Washington's farewell address. You've got, I don't know, nearly 500 pages here. You're saying to know America, crack open this body of expression and argue about it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I don't think Americans need to be told by me to do that, because that's what we've been doing from the very beginning. You know, we've always had a diverse nation. This has been a preoccupation of Americans from even in the midst of the revolution, is how do you bring together a people that's so diverse ethnically, racially, politically, linguistically? You know, how do you bring them together? And one hope has been, well, maybe there's a common idea. Maybe that idea is liberty. Maybe that idea is equality. But that just has never been the case. The case has been that we have articulated these ideals, and then we've debated what they mean and then how to prioritize them. You know, is liberty first? Well, Ayn Rand says so. But is equality first? Well, Abe Lincoln says so. That's part of the debate we're having now about the Occupy Wall Street, the 99 and the 1. You know, what do we care about more, liberty or equality? And what does it mean to talk about an egalitarian nation? And what does it mean to talk about a nation that values liberty? And it's through these texts that we have these arguments.
You've got grand documents in here, and you've got very pithy just proverbs. I mean, that I guess help frame us, a proverb powerful enough to make your American Bible. You've got Ben Franklin. Remember that time is money. Franklin, God helps those who help themselves. Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death. I mean, even Abigail Adams, remember the ladies in Sojourner Truth, ain't I a woman? What, even the latticework of Proverbs is part of what defines us?
I think some of these core expressions really do get boiled down to these individual words. It isn't so much the whole speech of Sojourner Truth that people think about it, but it's the ain't I a woman provocation that they go to in John F. Kennedy's first and only inaugural. You know, the core element there really is the ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And these are sort of formulas, a little bit like, you know, John 3:16 in the Bible or something, or these, you know, the 23rd Psalm, that people are looking at as really just statements. The business of America is business. Is that right? Or is the business of America something else?
FDR, I pledge you, I pledge myself to a new deal. Ronald Reagan brings the phrase evil empire. Some of these we know very well, some not as fully familiar. You mentioned Sojourner Truth and the speech in which she asked, ain't I a woman? Here's Cicely Tyson performing a rendition of that famous speech a couple of years ago in a congressional tribute to Sojourner Truth.
This man over there, yes, you, he say women's have to be helped into carriages, lifted over ditches, and to have the best place everywhere. Well, nobody ever helped me in no carriage, over no mud puddles, or gives me any best place, and ain't I a woman?
It says, mundane as a mud puddle, but then ain't I a woman? And the full weight of that phrase, as you hear it, Stephen?
Well, part of what makes it powerful is that you could take it in different directions, right? I think that excerpt there really points to, you know, I'm tough, and women are supposed to be, you know, sweet and weak, but ain't I a woman? I'm a tough gal, you know? But there's also the racial element there, right? That, here she is showing up at this conference. A lot of people didn't want her to be there, you know. And
the only African-American woman to speak, this is Ohio, 18, right. I don't even know the year.
That's right. And she's, and so ain't I a woman? I may be black, but, you know, ain't I a woman? So she's.
Am I not a full human being?
That's right. And this is the egalitarian question, right, the issue of equality. Who is included in this category of American? You know, who gets to vote? You know, who gets to be considered American? Immigrants, Muslims, Catholics, African Americans, people without property. This is a debate we have throughout American history.
And then you call your book American Bible. Then there's the question of how God feels about all this. You've got even song in here, God Bless America, which Ronald Reagan, I guess you're saying, brought to almost the end of every American presidential speech. But, of course, Irving Berlin wrote it. Kate Smith sang it. God Bless America, American Bible verse.
Well, it's a prayer. The song is a prayer, and there's a prologue to it that we usually don't hear if we go to the Republican National Convention or something. But it's a prayer, and it gets taken up. Yes, it gets taken up as a song that becomes very popular in American culture, and it gets taken up by presidents. It also gets criticized by Woody Guthrie, whose "This Land Is Your Land" is actually a kind of retort to Irving Berlin.
Stephen Prothero is with us. His new book is The American Bible, How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us. What words, what captures America for you, what it is, what it ought to be? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the words that define America, the speeches, the songs, the documents, the endless debate they contain. My guest, Stephen Prothero, has put them all together in his new book, The American Bible, he calls it, How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. Another cornerstone in his American Bible, much later than Washington and all the rest. This is JFK, John F. Kennedy, January 20th, 1961, in his inaugural address. Just this phrase, providing the nation with a memorable maxim.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
And in all the years since, picked up and spun and used in different directions by different people. Here, January 20th, 1973, in his second inaugural address, Richard Nixon echoed JFK's famous maxim in his speech.
Let us remember that America was built not by government, but by people. Not by welfare, but by work. Not by shirking responsibility, but by seeking responsibility. In our own lives, let each of us ask, not just what will government do for me, but what can I do for myself? In the challenges we face together, let each of us ask, not just how can government help, but how can I help?
Richard Nixon, not so euphonious, not so melodic, but playing off that, we'll look at his twist on it. And then one more January 20th. This is 2011, the 50th anniversary of JFK's inauguration. President Barack Obama spoke at the Kennedy Center and paid tribute to Kennedy and the legacy of his speech.
He knew that we, as a people, can do big things. We can reach great heights. We can rise to any challenge. So long as we're willing to ask what we can do for our country. So long as we're willing to take America's destiny into our own hands.
Richard Nixon and then Barack Obama taking off on American Bible entry, the Ask Not speech of JFK. 800-423-8255 is our number. Stephen Prothero, right there. You've got one of your cornerstones, and then this sort of, in effect, what turns into a kind of Talmudic commentary by two subsequent presidents.
Yeah, well, I wanted to thank you for that. I was thinking, oh, there's the Radio Talmud. You know, that's the idea I really started with
interpretations.
Yes, was this, you know, image on the page for those who have seen the Talmud is this core text in the center, and then surrounding it is just this sort of blooming, buzzing confusion of commentaries and controversy. And it seems to me that, you know, that just those three clips are a great example of, you know, this sort of centrist president of the Democrats with JFK giving this sort of argument about sacrifice, which turns into Nixon's argument for a kind of anti-60s, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, which turns into Obama's kind of hope. And this is what we see throughout the American Bible is Lincoln reinterpreting the Declaration as about equality, and then King reinterpreting the Gettysburg Address as being about segregation and about getting rid of Jim Crow. And there's this wonderful kind of commentary tradition around these core texts throughout American history that, to me at least, is really fascinating to see how these words can be bent and interpreted and misinterpreted and used and abused by people of both parties throughout American history.
Not everybody is happy to see you putting this terms of a kind of national Bible. You know, the American Bible, Gemley writes to us online, says it's ironic to see the Bible used as a metaphor of the American experience when the founders made special efforts to keep religion from gumming up the gears of government. What do you say, Stephen?
Well, the Bible in this sense that I'm using it doesn't mean the Christian Bible. It means Scripture. You know, we have Scripture in a lot of different religious traditions that is not the Christian Scripture. And I think what I'm trying to say is that we use these texts the way Christians use the Bible. I'm not trying to say that America is about religion. I think religion shows up a fair amount in a lot of these
mm-hmm.
texts.
Mm-hmm.
But religion has been an important part of American history. You know, that's a lot of my own work has been devoted to tracking the ways in which religion and politics mix and merge in American culture. But it's certainly not my point to say that Americans have been obsessed about Christianity. The point is to say Americans are a people of the book, and this is our book. You know, Twain is in a way our Matthew, and you know, Thomas Jefferson is in a way our Paul, and we quote them and we cite them and we use them for leverage in our arguments today.
Stephen Prothero's new book is The American Bible: How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. Let's go to our listeners. Melrose, Massachusetts. Dave is calling. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call, firstly, and hi, Stephen. Certainly a privilege to speak with you today. I, interestingly, read your article on Memorial Day, or your tribute to Memorial Day in the American Bible back in the Wall Street Journal on Friday, last
mm-hmm.
Friday.
Mm-hmm.
As I was reading through it, though, and I'm not a historian, so I don't know, you know, all necessarily the context here, but as I was reading through it, I couldn't help but be stumbled and a little bit baffled when I read that you included Atlas Shrugged as being one of those documents or one of those books that would contribute to the so-called Bible or collection of documents and literature, you know, that would contribute to the American theme and the American idea.
Atlas Shrugged, the Ayn Rand novel.
That's correct, mm-hmm. Ayn Rand. And you could have thrown in any one of her you know, more popular books, Fountainhead or whatnot, but Atlas Shrugged, it's a book that I enjoyed reading, but I'm just not sure that I would include it in such a context as this. And I was hoping that, Stephen, you could, explain a little bit why you included that. It did stumble me. I eventually read on throughout the rest of the article, but I spoke to my, you know, the folks that I was with at the time, and I said, I can't believe this guy is calling out Atlas Shrugged in this.
Well, because you think it's not worthy, Dave? It shouldn't be up there with the Declaration of Independence and, I don't know, Huckleberry Finn?
Yeah, and there's a lot of controversy around, her works, around objectivism, and around her kind of ideas to what freedom and liberty is really about.
I'll put that to Stephen Prothero. Let's hear from Ayn Rand herself first. And yes, her Atlas Shrugged, 1957, makes the American Bible line up here. This was 1959. She talked about Atlas Shrugged in an interview with Mike Wallace, who was then way back then on Nightbeat. Here's Ayn Rand summing up some of her views on society.
I'm for the separation of state and economics, just as we had separation of state and church, which led to peaceful coexistence among different religions after a period of religious wars. So the same applies to economics. If you separate the government from economics, if you do not regulate production and trade, you will have peaceful cooperation and harmony and justice among men.
There you go, Ayn Rand, 1959. Dave wants to know why Atlas Shrugged and Ayn Rand in the American Bible.
Well, he said, you know, first of all, that was the hardest part of the book. You know, the hardest part was coming up with a table of contents. What do you include and exclude? Anytime you try to figure out what a canon is, you know, you're going to have people upset that you included certain things, and you're going to have people upset that you excluded certain things. Where is my favorite person, or why is my least favorite person in the book? And I suspect that Dave isn't a fan of Atlas Shrugged or of Ayn Rand. He said that it's created a lot of controversy. Actually, that's the reason it's in the book. The two criteria I had for inclusion here were the ability, the capacity to generate a tradition of commentary and controversy, that's one, and then the insistence that it be about America and Americans. And Atlas Shrugged is a claim that America is about liberty. It's a libertarian book. It says that America is about capitalism, about the maximization of the exchange of money, individual freedom, and getting rid of the so-called moochers that created the welfare state and things like that. So there's a lot of people, obviously, who hate this book, but it's been a lot in the news lately. It's really, in a way, the Bible of the contemporary Republican budget agreement. This is the sort of...
Explicitly, by no small number. I mean, Paul Ryan says, look, I read Ayn Rand, and that really...
That's why I got into public service. Mm-hmm. And so, and there's a debate on the right about, you know, Ayn Rand... was an atheist who thought Christianity was a horrible thing. And, of course, the Republican Party now has very much embraced conservative Christianity. And so they're of two minds about her. But I have to admit, I do think Rand is something of a marginal choice, in part because she's so recent. I mean, in 50 years, will we still be talking about her? But her book sells about as well as any other book in American life consistently over and over every year. Hundreds of thousands of copies, even this year.
And crystallized something very potent in American politics, certainly. Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts. Kevin, thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I think a book that gets short shrift in the American canon, is one of the most important novels ever written was The Grapes of Wrath by Steinbeck. It chronicled the journey of the Joads during Dust Bowl Depression to California and the indifference that they faced on their journey the whole time they were in California, going from camp to camp. Very little government safety nets. Probably the saddest ending of any novel I ever read.
Yeah.
The only aid they get in the whole novel is that one time they're in a government camp. Everything else is pretty much a horror show. And I think that it's a pretty good illustration of what happens in a society where there are no safety nets and everything is just left up to chance. The pick yourself up by your bootstrap, folks. I think that's what the Joads tried to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure millions of others who made that same journey and all throughout the Depression. And I think that it's a very good example of what can happen when there's indifference as opposed to at least a little bit of assistance from the government.
Kevin, I'm really glad you raised that. Such a powerful book. Brought me to tears reading it back in the day as a teenager. And absolutely. So let's put it. I mean, Stephen, you have three big works of fiction in here. Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, and Atlas Shrugged, No Grapes of Wrath.
Well, I thought about Grapes of Wrath, of course. It's maybe the great book about class in American American history. And if I had three volumes, I think it would have found its way in. One of the decisions I made in the book is I think race is the great American problem. I think it's slavery is the, to persist in the biblical metaphor, the original sin of American life. And race is the perennial challenge. And so two of the three novels that I selected are about race. Huckleberry Finn is said by many to be the most racist book in our canon. It's also said by many to be the great anti-racist book in our canon. So that seemed to me to have to be there. Harriet Beecher Stowe's book may be the most influential book ever published in America. Many people think that's what gave us the war. That's what gave
Abe
the determination.
Lincoln said as much.
Yes, the little lady who gave us the Great War when she was visiting in the White House. So It seems to me it's hard to not have either of those two books. And then I decided to include the Rand book because I wanted to have a book in there that was really about capitalism and making the strongest possible case that America is actually not about equality at all. And it's really not even about politics. It's about the economy. It's about capitalism. And so that's why I included that. But, you know,
Kevin might feel a little better if you had a little Grapes of Wrath balancing that particular fulcrum.
Maybe so. Like I say, if I had three volumes, Steinbeck would be there.
Yeah. Let's listen. I mean, here's the racial note, of course. August 28th, 1963, March on Washington, Martin Luther King Jr. rallied the nation to end racial discrimination with his I Have a Dream speech.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal.
From Stephen Prothero's American Bible, Mirza in Boston. Thanks for calling, Mirza. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Yeah, the point I just wanted to make is that I feel the United States is about individualism and individual persons, and that there isn't any one overriding culture. And if you assume that there's a so-called American Bible, you know, then you exclude a lot of people with that. That there's this assumption that there's this true America, and everybody else should come and adapt and be more like true American. That cowboy hat is more belongs here more than a sombrero, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And just listening to your discussion, you know, a bunch of historic mainstream figures plus Martin Luther King. You know, there's no room for Mexican Americans, for example, who've been here before. I mean,
no, Mirza, I hear it loud and clear, and I'll put it to Stephen Prothero. It's a very interesting observation, but it all it goes to the question that people think a lot about. I wonder what you think, Mirza. If there is no overarching set of ideals, then are we really just a bunch of people from all over? Is that what you're saying?
Right. And exactly. I mean, there is one majority culture, but there isn't one culture that covers everybody. And in fact, lately, there's been this implicit assumption, you know, that people who come to the United States should adapt and be more like, I don't know, some ideal person, that you should, you know, change your ethnic food for hot dogs and change your ethnic hat for baseball hat.
Well, I don't know about hot dogs. Our time is short before the break, but maybe some ideals. What about Stephen Prothero? Just we have a majority culture, or by calling this the American Bible, are you suggesting that we have a common aspirational culture? Do we?
I'm saying we have a common conversation, and I'm saying that this caller is participating in that conversation by explicitly saying, you know, where are the Mexican Americans here? You know, we're part of America too. I think that's part of our national conversation. So I'm getting away. Well, that's not true, because actually there are voices from Latinos and Mexican Americans. Cesar Chavez has a wonderful riff on the Declaration of Independence. It's called The Plan of Delano. And
his commentary.
He, in fact, makes my point, because if Chavez wants to say, you know, we Mexican-American laborers need to have greater rights in American society, we need to be able to organize, he doesn't do it on behalf of just his own thoughts. He has to make the connection, like King made in the I Have a Dream speech, to the Declaration of Independence. And that's the strategy that's effective in American life, and that's the strategy that minorities have used throughout American culture. We are part of this country, and they do it by channeling, interpreting these core texts. That's the way they make their way in, and that's the way they articulate who they are here.
Mirza, thank you for your call. We heard God Bless America. Woody Guthrie heard it too back in the day and wrote this song in opposition to its kind of hail, hail patriotism. This Land is Your Land, 1944, this singing. Stephen Prothero's new book is The American Bible, How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. This Land is Your Land makes the cut. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
That's cloud rolling. A voice was chanting as the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the words that define America, the speeches, the songs, the documents, the endless debate they contain and inspire. My guest, Stephen Prothero, has put them all together in his new book, The American Bible, How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. October 1964, in a pre-recorded television event for presidential candidate Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan gave the speech which would thrust him into the political spotlight. They called it the speech in Reagan circles. Fervor for American ideals, at least as he interpreted them, would pave his way to the White House.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
The last best hope for man on earth, and a little Jimmy Cagney inflection there, I'm hearing, Stephen.
And he's quoting Thomas Paine. So you've got, you know, that's one thing interesting here, that these core texts are often themselves commentaries on other core texts. One other interesting thing about that speech is when you read it and hear it, it doesn't have the optimism. I mean, that was a real short clip, but it's a Cold War darkness, and it's really, there's danger lurking in every corner. There's fear to be had, whereas Reagan, of course, becomes so famous for his, you know, optimism. It's the morning in America, and things are getting better and better.
But he makes your American Bible with this speech because it speaks to that sense of, hang on, if we lose it, we're lost. We're the last best hope, city on a hill kind of rhetoric?
Because it points to where the Republican Party is going to go for the next 50 years. And it becomes the touchstone for the critique of particularly the 60s and also the sense of creeping socialism, that communism isn't just something over in other countries we have to worry about. It's creeping here into the welfare state at home. And that becomes something we've been debating for the last in my whole lifetime.
Let's go to Jeff in Saranac Lake, New York. Jeff, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I would just contend that talk about what the theme of this book is, or what the and it would seem to me that the overarching theme of the book itself is the simple fact that we are free as a people, regardless of our origins, regardless of our circumstances, to engage in these debates, and that these debates have been going on for several hundred years and will continue to go on. And more than any other society in the history of humankind, we can engage in those debates. And I think that is as important as anything else.
Do you feel a common goal in that debate, Jeff?
I'm sorry. I'm in a fringe cell phone area, and
okay.
I wasn't able to hear.
We'll take your comment, and I appreciate it, that freedom to have the debate.
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, I think that one point I'm making in the book is that debate and argument is a ritual, and it's a ritual that can bring a community together. This is how it works in the Jewish tradition. You know, the old joke about, you know, two Jews and three positions, because there's this whole tradition of arguing, you know, what makes you Jewish? Is it that you have a creed, that you believe in God? Well, no, a lot of my Jewish friends don't believe in God. What makes you Jewish is to participate in this community of memory, this chain of memory, this debate, this conversation about what does it mean to be Jewish? And I think that that's what's happening in America. Now, this only happens if we can do the debate in a way that's informed and that's civil. And I think that's one of the stresses on this right of our republic nowadays. But traditionally throughout American history, it's been this process of arguing that has brought us together.
But it is more, it is a debate, maybe an endless debate, a debate, though, that you say, looking at this kind of Talmudic interpretation, you say the best debates in the Jewish tradition were arguing for the sake of God, not just for the sake of debate itself. But surely there is some kind of core set of ideas here. I come back to that. This is not just a wide open field. This is not just some point in infinite space.
I think that I agree with that. I think there are some core concepts that we debate, just like in any religious tradition, right? You have Christians who want to talk about symbols like Christ and sacrifice, or Muslims who want to talk about symbols like Muhammad and the Quran and Allah and monotheism. We have those too. We have our democracy. We have our capitalism. We have our equality. We have our unity. And we know that those are our touchstones, but so are the touchstones of these texts that we keep returning to. You can't just pull out of thin air an argument about something in American culture. You have to ground it somewhere. And where we ground it is with these great thinkers and their great themes.
Damien writes to us online, wants to turn to Abe Lincoln. Of course, Gettysburg Address looms large in your collection here. He says, more than ever, we need to heed Lincoln's vision of an America with a government of the people, by the people, for the people. Oliver in Dedham, Massachusetts. Oliver, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to know what your guest thinks about our country's motto, which I've heard put two different ways. One I've heard is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and I've also heard it as life, liberty, and property. In contrast, France has as its motto liberty, equality, and brotherhood. So I'd just like to know how we develop these two different mottos and what your guest thinks of the choice of words say about our perception of ourselves and our country. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks, Oliver. Stephen?
Well, the formula that Jefferson is conjuring in the Declaration comes from the European tradition, and it is life, liberty, and property. But he drops property and substitutes it with happiness. I think this is monumental. People have written whole, volumes about this. That America is, in a way, about the pursuit of happiness. It's not merely about the defense of property, like Ayn Rand claims. And the pursuit of happiness is a very odd kind of idea. It's not something that societies have typically aimed at. It's a very modern conception. Even my grandfather, I remember when my brother quit his job once, he said, I didn't like my job. And my grandfather said, well, what does that have to do? It didn't make me happy. What does that have to do with anything? But it's
pursuit
very,
of happiness, Grandpa.
I mean, no, you're supposed to support your family. That's why you work. But so the pursuit of happiness, where exactly Jefferson gets that, there's been reams written about that too. But I think it's right to point to that because I think there are a lot of Americans who think that's what this place is about. This place is about where we can maximize our happiness as individuals and when we have a government that conspires to make us happy.
Give us a couple back-to-back, and maybe they sit in the great big arc of American Bible here. George Washington's farewell address seems to in my reading, to have a special place in your canon here. Then you've got Malcolm X in his autobiography. But George Washington, in his farewell address, most important there?
Well, his farewell address addresses three themes. He says religion is a pillar of American government. He says that we need to not have entangling alliances with other countries. It's dangerous to be too close, too much in love or too much in hate with other countries. And then the third point has to do with the mischiefs of party. And I think this is really important.
Mischief of party.
The mischiefs of the political party. Mm-hmm. When we have such troubles now in our country with petty partisanship, that's really my main worry. And it's really, in a way, the worry to which this book is addressed. We have a great tradition of conciliation here. And I think we should listen to words of people who figure out how to put nation above party. And this is some great language, just a few sentences from the farewell address of George Washington, 1796. I should read it.
Sure, please.
Yeah. The common and continual mischiefs of the spirit of party are sufficient to make it the interest and duty of all wise people to discourage and restrain it. It serves always to distract the public councils and enfeeble the public administration. It agitates the community with ill-founded jealousies and false alarms, kindles the animosity of one part against another, foments occasionally riot and insurrection. It opens the door to foreign influence and corruption, which finds a facilitated access to the government itself through the channels of party passion. So here we are, the first president telling us, beware of party.
Don't take it too far.
Look out.
Abraham Lincoln picks up on that in the Gettysburg Address, and you quote him. I mean, it's almost plaintive, him saying, the President Lincoln, we are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. That spirit often lost in American politics lately. Hiram's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hiram, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I haven't really had the opportunity to read too much of what you've written, Stephen, but look forward to buying the book. I guess my question, I'm curious how you treat Mormonism or the Book of Mormon as kind of a unique kind of American homegrown religion and religious text, and how you see that kind of theme of either religious isolation or exclusivism playing out as kind of a part of the American dream.
Great question, especially right now with our Mormon candidate, Mitt Romney.
Well, there aren't any Mormon texts that are included in the American Bible. We have the Book of Mormon, which, of course, makes America a very important place in the history of Christianity and in the history of the universe, I guess. But
many people might not understand what you're referring to there. Maybe you could
elaborate. The Book of Mormon makes the claim that Jesus before he ascended to heaven, comes to North America and establishes his true church here. And this is the hope that Mormons have, that something like the Garden of Eden in the past was in somewhere like Missouri, and something like heaven will be here in the future. So America plays...
And gives America a divine role, quite literally, in the Book of Mormon, if I read you correctly.
That's right. And this is one concern that some people have about Mitt Romney, that there may be a sort of American exceptionalism on steroids here, with the belief of Mormons that, as Romney himself has talked about, that the Constitution and the Declaration are divinely inspired. This is something that Mormon leaders have claimed. It's not a point of doctrine in Mormonism, but it's an interesting point of commentary in the American Bible about both the Declaration and the Constitution, that they were somehow inspired by God, not just these wonderful documents by these great, wonderful founders in America. But
so if Mitt Romney is elected president, in your edition 2 of American Bible, you think you'll have the Book of Mormon in there?
Well, no, but I think I will have Romney's recent comments in February about how perhaps the Constitution and the Declaration were divinely inspired. Unfortunately, he said that after my book went to press.
Edward, calling from Newport News, Virginia. Edward, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I was just calling. I wanted to say that I think this is a really great opportunity to have this book published and put out for people to discuss these things. And there's just I believe it's a great opportunity to have a lot of room for growth in our country.
Room for growth. You've got to love that. We're a growing country in many directions. Edward, I appreciate your call. One more. Toronto, Canada. Frank is calling. Frank, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was listening a little while ago, and you're talking about whether we're more of a single American culture or many, many separate individual mm-hmm. cultures. And what I recall years ago hearing expressed this way, that we've been called a melting pot, but we're really not. We're much more like a tapestry, where each thread retains its original character and color and so forth, but all together we make a beautiful whole.
Do these ideas hold that tapestry together, or does it hold itself together, Frank?
I think it works both ways. The individual cultures feed the whole, yet the people who are part of the whole, the whole supports the individual the threads, and the threads support the greater whole.
Frank, you're a real tapestry guy, and I appreciate that. Let me get one more, if I may. Christine's calling from Noank, Connecticut. Christine, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
Words are very important, and one of my concerns is that all women on the planet here should be included in all the books we have today. Humankind is a great word. Someone mentioned that on the radio. I think that's wonderful. And the only thing is, a fellow came on and said something about brotherhood. I think it should be some other word we should select that would include us all. I think that's extremely important in today's. It's 2012. We need to get with it. I also think that our president could do a better job when he speaks sometimes and include some more positive words, like the Reagan administration, and some more. He's a little bit harsh. He's a little bit hard-edged. And we need to feel better about ourselves. I think that's an important thing, and I think it could do a lot more for making us all feel better about ourselves.
Christine, I appreciate both of those. Our time is short. Let me take it first to the issue of gender. Many more men than women here. Now, maybe that's just history talking to us, Stephen.
Right. Well, there's women. Definitely there's women included both as authors of core texts, right? With Maya mm-hmm. Lin, who's making the Vietnam Memorial, Ayn Rand, Abigail Adams, Sojourner Truth. But yes, there's more men than women, and the reason for that is because men have had louder voices. They grabbed the megaphone for most of American history. The women appear here particularly in the commentaries. So the commentaries have a slant toward the contemporary. So mm-hmm. I'm always looking for, you know, what are people saying today about Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience, or what are they saying today about the Gettysburg Address or the Declaration? And there's many women, from Gloria Steinem to Sarah Palin to many other women who are commenting in the book. I'd like to say one quick thing about this whole question about the one and the many, which is the big lurking issue behind this American Bible Project, right? This kind of anxiety Americans have always had about what holds us together. And something holds us together because we have an incredibly diverse society. And we've had one civil war, but since then we haven't had another. And I think what I'm trying to do here is sort of split the difference between an idea that we have a single creed that we all agree on and the idea that we just are off kind of doing our own thing. I don't think that that's true. I think we have an argument. We have a conversation like a family might have at a table where people have very different ideas. They're very different people, but they get together to talk, to converse, maybe even to disagree strongly. I think that's what we have in American society. I think that's what holds us together, and I think that's what gives me hope that we aren't just kind of spinning into craziness in our current epidemic of petty partisanship.
We've got just half a minute. How does Maya Lin's great stone monument, sort of cut into the earth in Washington, the Vietnam Memorial, make it into your book of words, text?
Well, this was a suggestion of a friend of mine. I had never considered it. I was there when it was being built. I was living in D.C., and this friend of mine said to me, you have to have Maya Lin. I said, well, this is a book of documents. It's not a text.
And speeches, she said, songs.
Look at it. You know, it's two pages of a book opened up, cut into the earth with words on it, right? And the words are the names of these 58,000 dead soldiers. And if you want to say it needs to have controversy to make it in the book, this is a big controversy.
And what does it say, that stone book in the earth?
Well, what it says is so wonderful. It refuses to say what the war is about. It refuses to say if America is an exceptional nation or not. And you stand there and you look in the mirror of the wall and you get to figure that out for yourself, you know?
Stephen Prothero's new book is The American Bible, How Our Words Unite, Divide, and Define a Nation. You can read an excerpt at our website. Stephen Prothero, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll go out with a voice, Beyonce's, and part of that Bible, the Star-Spangled Banner. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.